Hello, and welcome back to the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast. If this is your first time joining us, I hope you enjoy your stay. Those of you who have listened to the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast for a while have heard a specific topic come up several times. We've teased the idea, we've floated a few concepts that involve it, but we have not actually fully dived into it. I'm excited to say that if you've been waiting patiently for that episode, the wait is over today. We are finally talking about data privacy and security. As we've alluded to every time we've brought it up in the past, this is a very large topic. We're not going to cover all of data privacy and security today. We're actually planning on focusing on the fundamentals of those topics, going over what data privacy and security mean as concepts and what they mean for your data science work and products. I am welcoming four members from the team at Klaviyo today who know a lot about data privacy and security. All of you are on the podcast for the first time, so first off, welcome. I'm going to ask each of you to give a quick introduction. Let us know who you are, which part of the team you work on, and what you do there. Let's go ahead and start off with Lauren.
Hello, my name's Lauren Worcester. I am a senior governance, risk, and compliance analyst here at Klaviyo on the risk and trust team. I work under Dom, who will introduce himself very shortly. Basically, we just understand Klaviyo's risk environment, do our best to remediate them. We own our control program as well. And also specifically, we're pretty involved in the data privacy work internally here.
On that topic, Dom.
Yeah, thank you for having us on, for hosting on this topic. I'm Dom Lombardi. I'm the Senior Manager of Security, Risk, and Trust. The only other thing I'll add with the introduction that Lauren gave is that we really try and partner with teams around control, implementation, remediation. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that as the conversation goes on today. That's a big part of what our team looks to do with other stakeholders around risk reduction.
Fantastic. Next up, Dave.
Hi, I'm Dave Shao. I'm a lead data scientist here at Klaviyo. And in a previous life, I was in academia and studied areas including cryptography and privacy. So this is a topic that's very close to my heart.
Awesome. And Andres.
Thanks, Michael. I am Andres Tuckles. I work on the SRE team, specifically focusing on security. So I guess you can think of it as a way that I'm on an engineering team that has a focus on figuring out how to actually like implement the guidance and best practices and controls and policies, and in some ways how to balance it out between what developers need versus what is a safe and good practice and what you want to do.
I hope it comes through for everyone listening to this episode. We have a wealth of experience here today, so I'm just going to dive straight into the conversation. We've teased this topic for a while, as I mentioned. I want to start out with some basic definitions just to make sure everyone starts on the same page. What do we mean when we say data privacy? And what do we mean when we say security?
I can take a first stab at that. Research in this area, I think there is a pretty well-defined difference between security research and privacy research. In general, security is thinking about what are the possible mistakes or possible weaknesses in the way that we've implemented systems. Our firewalls are blocking the right kinds of traffic, making sure that our code doesn't have bugs in it that will let attackers access data maliciously. I think the contrast between that and privacy is that privacy is more talking about the kinds of assurances we can give our users when the algorithms and software that we're using is actually operating as it is intended. Is our data analysis private? So we have some data analysis that we intend to do. It's running the way we intend it to run. Does the result of that analysis compromise any user's privacy unintentionally, even though the algorithm itself was actually operating the way it was supposed to?
I think that's a very interesting perspective to learn. For me, privacy usually is, it's more about the users, more from the perspective of the end user and the ability or in some sense, right to control kind of what information about you is out there and where. And then security in one sentence basically would be all sorts of mechanisms, how we as a company ensure that we actually have control over it. For example, if a user has entrusted their data to us so that we can run the algorithms and we can do the computations and calculations, how do we ensure we are the only ones who see that information and it doesn't get leaked or lost anywhere else?
For data privacy, usually I like to think of it as kind of two different prongs. The first being me as an individual, as a consumer of a certain product or service, how I am able to control how a company uses my data, how I'm able to ensure that it's protected, that it's private, and that it's being shared with who I want, that's being used in the way that I'm consenting to. And that's kind of baseline. And the second piece of that being what data privacy is for corporations or companies that are handling and using that data, and how they are protecting it to the best of their ability in order to protect the rights of the consumers that they're granting them. Security, I always like to say, is a little bit more straightforward than some of the data privacy concepts we discuss. But speaking about like the controls, the protections, all of the safeguards that we also put into place to protect all of that data as well as ourselves.
Yeah, some of the two big things that I think of when I think of privacy are consent and trust, both from me as a data subject and my rights to my data, and then from an organization's perspective on how they build and cultivate that trust with their constituencies and the customers that they serve, incorporating elements of privacy by design into the security controls that you're then building to really maintain that environment and protect the data that you have and the systems that your product and your services.
Sounds like there's definitely a clear relationship between privacy and security then.
I think so. And I also like that how you can see from three different perspectives, because it's all related, even though we all said in a slightly different way.
These are large topics. I've said that a few times now. Data privacy and security are large topics, and I would wager they're large enough that just about everyone who's listening to this episode has heard of them before, probably encountered them in real ways before. I would say it's probably a baseline assumption for most of our audience that data privacy and security are good things. I like to dive into the why. I'd like to take a second to dive into the why of data privacy and security. Why are they important concepts when you're making software and doing data science work?
Dom referred to the notion of trust and how our customers are trusting us with that data. So I think that for me is one of the things that I pay very close attention to when we are thinking about new algorithms that we want to explore, new techniques we want to try. Are we honoring that trust that our customers are putting in us to treat their data with as much privacy as possible?
Especially when you are talking about building software that is B2B in nature, not B2C. So not necessarily even thinking about protecting the data that you're storing on your consumers, but rather how do we empower the customers that we have in a B2B space to be able to best serve their end users as well. So building privacy principles and privacy tools that kind of start with what we're developing and trickle down and empower the end user at the very bottom of the kind of in between the two of us.
I also think to that point, you got to remember that at the end of the day, the users, at least theoretically, are sharing the data voluntarily. They're going to share it as long as they trust us. If they stop trusting us, then we are going to have a lot less data that we can analyze and come up with things. So that I think is also something to remember.
All relationships that you build and cultivate are based off of an element of trust. And for us to continue to kind of serve a growing constituency, it's really important that we put their rights as data subjects and rights as our customers in mind as we're building out our platform and building up the controls and processes that support our continued growth.
I think that's a good point to raise here. One way that I like to think of trust is there are many, many different ways to build trust, but the ways that you break trust are fairly universal. So I'd like to get into that, a little bit of that question of context. Are there any specific contexts either within Klaviyo or that you've worked in the past where certain aspects of the data privacy and security questions have been especially important or relevant just because of the context that you're working in?
Yeah, I've worked in healthcare spaces before, you know, highly regulated data elements, requirements of how businesses handle and process that data are more stringently and uniformly enforced. I think what's really interesting about the market that Klaviyo sits in is that the privacy landscape is changing, and it's changing very rapidly. And as our customer base grows, we have to build and design our program to really be the most efficient for constituencies we serve and what the data privacy requirements are from a global perspective.
Yeah, I would say that I have been blessed to not work in the healthcare space when it comes to data privacy. I've kind of sat in that sweet spot of being in tech where it's moved from being not really regulated and we're trying to figure it out here in the United States to working at a more international company where GDPR is applicable. We've got CCPA, we've got tens of 20s of new laws coming out in the United States. So nothing like healthcare, I will say. But I think one thing that is important also to kind of consider is when you are in a B2C space, not just B2B, B2C as well, it is important to think about the end user and some of the principles that we think about for privacy by design and having privacy settings as the default. With B2C, a lot of times when you do serve these customers, their terms of service, how often do we read them? Not very. I'll admit that too. So we need to be sure that we're enabling privacy as a default and as the original settings for these customers so that they can feel comfort and they can understand and build that trust with the company that they are sharing willingly their data with. When we talk about a B2B space, we can negotiate these contracts. We can decide what terms of what data is being shared, what's not being shared. When do you delete it? When I'm gone. But it's not that simple in the B2C space. So just making sure that we are taking care to build out those settings by the default.
What can happen if you aren't careful enough? What are some of the fail states or potentially, you know, I don't want to get too cataclysmic here, but what are some of the worst case scenarios that happen if you aren't careful enough when you're building privacy and security tools?
I think for a company, the worst thing is you become the front page of the news. That's a huge reputational risk. We've seen all of these news in about hacks and information leaks. And while for the company, it's just data for people, like if your social security number gets leaked, I mean, now people can basically impersonate you and steal your identity. So that's probably one of the biggest things that can happen. But besides that, even just in general, if you don't have these good controls in place, you can hurt yourself. Things like if you don't have a good enough security, say some virus or some hacker come in and can corrupt your work. So even if you say didn't expose anything, even if say your database was very encrypted, but say you had a little bit more lax security in terms of who can get access to it, you can lose your own work.
Of course, there's always the worst case scenario, which you automatically think of. I don't want to name names, but we've all seen those companies in the news. But another thing to think through is that if companies don't do a very mindful job of incorporating privacy and security at the front end of their development or at the start of the development of certain software or anything like that, you then retrospectively have a ton of debt that you have incurred just because you didn't think about these principles and these concepts, and you didn't think for the emerging landscape in terms of what privacy regulations are coming down the pipeline. So I'm a company that's in Massachusetts. We don't have a comprehensive data privacy bill like there is in California or abroad or anything like that. However, if you still kind of proceed as if that's not going to change, which isn't the case, things are changing all the time and new legislation is being introduced. And then you all of a sudden have to go back and adhere to all these principles, which is what a lot of people had to do with GDPR. We now have insight into how the landscape is changing. So at this point in time, if you don't build these principles into your programs, your tools from the jump, there's a ton of technical debt that you can incur as a company as well.
Yeah, and it's usually harder to change things that are already in place than to build it straight away with the privacy in the right way. Mm-hmm. And that's time you sacrifice with not building features. And I also think we haven't talked about it yet, but regulators, they also keep an eye on you. I used to come from the fintech space. Anytime you process any of that sort of data, you have to keep in mind that if you don't employ all the proper practices, regulators are going to come and take a look at you and going to have a conversation. While that might not be, again, the worst case, that is still already somebody coming with a stick instead of a carrot.
Worst case is that you violate that trust. And if you think about personal relationships that you have where someone has violated your trust, or you may have been in that role, it's really hard to build that back with customers and to gain and develop market penetration into new areas. So if you know you are working in a unregulated industry and you want to move into a more highly regulated industry, if your organization has a history of security incidents, it's much more difficult to penetrate new markets and to take your product into new areas. So there's a lot of balancing, like you said, security by design and privacy by design work versus releasing new features and paying down debt that teams need to work together to balance. And I think that's an important part about how you build out the controls and the security part of your program to complement the privacy work that you need.
There's been an interesting kind of case recently where a company basically just kind of operated under the same security and privacy principles that they had implemented for the past 10, 15 or so years, which as we know, those become very quickly outdated. And because of not only their poor security, but as well as like the poor privacy practices that they really didn't implement. Another worst case scenario is that you may not have faced a fine in the United States from a specific regulator, but regulators are looking more in the United States now at companies that have data breaches and the poor security that led to them. So it's kind of almost like hand in hand now at this point, where we say privacy, of course, comes with these fines too, but we're really starting to take a hard focus on security practices and principles as well that are also not in place to protect the data that gets breached and stolen.
Yeah, and as like companies accrue more and more data, they become more and more juicy targets for anybody who wants the access to that data. So the more data you have, the better you need to protect it.
That gives us a sense of kind of why data privacy and security matter, also a good sense of who they matter to. So I'd like to move on to a little more of how. We've heard some of these concepts thrown out, like security by design, privacy by design. What are some of the ways that you can actually ensure data privacy and security? I'm obviously, to be clear, not asking you to reveal any secret sauce on the air here, but just what are some of the general principles or practices that you find tend to help with that?
Yeah, I'd love to share some ideas from data science that are used in this area. So there's been a long line of work from like statisticians, especially at the Census Bureau, working on this kind of stuff. And then in the last, 20 years or so, being picked up by the computer science community. A lot of the early work in this area focused on redacting data, removing personally identifiable information from data sets like names, addresses, phone numbers, things like that. That has fallen a little bit out of vogue in the last 20 years because of certain limitations to that. One very important limitation is that that kind of redaction is not very useful against attacks that are able to leverage side information. So if I can like correlate additional pieces of information that I have from outside sources to the information that is being published by you, let's say you're the Census Bureau or something, I'm actually able to mount like very powerful attacks against that, because the two pieces of information together let me learn a lot more than they do on their own. So there was a very interesting attack, I believe in the 90s. This was a researcher named LaTanya Sweeney, who was at Harvard at the time, where she took public information that was released from two sources. One was from the Massachusetts Group Insurance Commission. So this is like a state commission that releases data periodically to help health insurers calculate their premiums so they can like calibrate to risk and stuff. And voter registration rolls, which are public information. And from those two different data sources, she was actually able to identify the health records of the former governor, Bill Welt, because it turned out that his information was released as part of that anonymized medical record data set. And his name had been removed, but his record included his zip code, his sex, and his age. And it turns out that those three pieces of information are also available from the voter registration rolls, and that they are actually highly uniquely identifying. So 87% of people are uniquely identifiable by those three pieces of data. And so by putting those two things together, she was able to discover his information and publish that. Well, she didn't publish it. The insurance commission published it. She just pointed out that it was in there. We've tried, and that, they do work in certain situations, but they have their limitations. Another area that's been very active in the research community in the last 20 years is called differential privacy. And this is a way of proactively, but in a very calibrated way, adding noise to data in order to obscure any single individual's data within that data set. So, obviously, if you add like tons and tons of noise to data, then you're intuitively making it private, because then all that you're seeing is noise. You're not seeing any data anymore. The challenge is, how do you like calibrate the amount of noise that you add so that the data set is still useful, but you add enough noise that destroys the amount of information it has about any single individual in that data set. And so that's been a really active area of research. It's been implemented in practice in the last couple of years at places, the Census Bureau for one, but also at companies like Apple, Google, others, using that as part of the way that they anonymize data. So for example, Apple and Google use differential privacy as part of the way that they collect keystroke data for things like text completion. When you're like on your iPhone and you're writing something out, they need to collect data in order to know how to predict the rest of the word. And they're actually applying differential privacy in that context to anonymize that data to some extent.
It's really interesting. I think since this is an episode about fundamentals, I don't know if we're probably able to get into like all of the details on differential privacy, but I would like to include a few links for people who want to learn more. If you're listening to this episode and you think differential privacy sounds really cool, check out the show notes. We'll have links to places to learn more about that.
I can jump in, maybe not necessarily on differential privacy, but that whole story did remind me about a couple of social engineering attacks that happened within the last few years. where even redacted information was available and people were able to utilize the redacted information to gain access to some other privileged accounts. In this case, I don't remember which exactly company that was, but I think everybody has seen a common pattern where whenever you give your credit card details to anybody, whenever they repeat it back to you, they usually obstruct everything except the last four digits. Well, as luck would have it, another major provider, if you had credit card on your account and you could provide the last four digits of your credit card, you were able to gain access to the account as a recovery method. So the attackers were able to actually exploit information in one part to get access to a completely different system. And these days, I would say social vectors, I don't know, actually, probably I should let Dom and Lauren speak more about that, but I think social vectors are the bigger and more likely threat that's going to get you than actual technical hackers and attacks. Just another example is, I don't know how many people have heard about Bank of Bangladesh and their money being stolen a few years ago through Swift network. And what it turned out, that the whole start for it was people accidentally opened the wrong documents. And then there were a couple of other compounding issues happening for that. But in the end, that led attackers to be able to gain access basically of the entire bank's reserves and be able to transfer them out. And it was a very cool story. NPR did a very nice episode about it, how it all unfolded. On a tangent note, those are the things that can happen, and that's why it matters. And how do you implement it? Like, what kind of controls you put in place to try to prevent against those areas?
Yeah, I won't disagree with you on social being a big potential threat, just because statistics and data have shown that people since March of 2020, the start of the pandemic, have gotten actually worse at protecting themselves from bad actors and threats. So it is kind of on the uprise, especially as bad actors become more sophisticated. So if your data is going to be breached, exposed, leaked by either employees internally or a bad actor externally, then speaking about foundations of privacy by design, those are kind of the principles that you need to implement, again, foundationally, just so that you can at the bare minimum be ready if and when those do happen. So things like minimizing the amount of data that you're collecting from individuals or storing on consumers, minimizing the amount of data or personally identifiable information that you're using in certain analytics, making sure that you can do analytics and analyze the data, these massive data sets that you have, and source insights that can't be pointed back to a specific person or specific group of people. I think those are also important as well. Some other things we can talk about are retention too. You know, if you only store data as recently as like the past couple of years, if someone tries to get in, you only have that amount of data to worry about versus if you don't have a strict retention timeline for specific pieces of information, sensitive or not, it also helps with costs and efficiencies there too. So it's kind of a win-win scenario. There's a lot of other foundational kind of privacy by design elements that are not super difficult to implement. We talk about strong encryption as well. That's foundational to talking about privacy. So just embedding some of these and being mindful about where these are embedded in your systems when you're talking about data classification as well, making sure that you have stronger systems in place for that really sensitive data versus data that is more public in nature. But I did love your example, Dave, of inferential data and being able to point back to someone, because I think that's a big misconception of data privacy is that, well, you know, I only have an IP address on someone and their purchasing history. What does that really have to do with who this person is? Like, how can I tell that that's Lauren based off of just this IP address and their purchasing history? But if in another database, I have Lauren Worcester and IP address, you can all of a sudden kind of tie those things together and find out who I am and exactly what I've done and how I've interacted with all of these kind of different companies that I'm not aware of as a consumer potentially. So it's important to keep those things in mind too.
And I think the systems also these days have gotten like so good at predicting who you are, even better than maybe you even realize. Don't remember the exact company, but I know at the earlier days of starting to analyze consumer behavior and what they buy, Lauren's example about IP address and your purchasing history, what does that tell people about it? Well, scientists, analysts at this one company were able to basically predict whether you were pregnant or not, for example, just based on your habits. And I think it's a commonly known case, what happened there. But that raises a question of like, even if you can figure something out about a person, should you? That's also, I think, where privacy comes in a lot.
Yeah, that really goes back to the trust of it all. The other thing I wanted to point out is that there is now kind of a recent movement in the privacy space for reconsidering the protections of certain data that we can't change is what we're kind of calling it. So talking about data that can be breached or exposed or stolen when it comes to data that can be changed. So for example, if my username and my password, my email, my password get compromised, I can change my username or my password any day of the week. But when we're talking about data that's related to who I am as an individual and my being that I cannot change, so biometrics, my face, my fingerprints, my social security number, I don't think you can change that. That's kind of, unless you have a good contact in, I don't know, able to completely change your identity, we won't go down that path. But talking about protecting that information that is around those kind of areas of the your person that you can't change and being more specifically protective of those as we start moving towards using more of those pieces of data in our day-to-day and our businesses.
Yeah, and when you talk about how to protect it, I think we've talked a lot about general principles, but I think it also you have to think about technically how you're going to do it, because there's governance that you can set up, but then there's how do you actually implement it. That also sometimes has a big effect and piece on how you're going to do it. What I'm thinking, for example, here is a couple of principles that weren't necessarily mentioned yet. Who needs access to what data, which is just a general policy, but then there's an implementation through, for example, you implement it through usernames or you through roles or through keys or through some other access. And depending on which sort of mechanism you choose, you can implement the policy to a certain degree. How you implement it depends also at which level of the organization you are, meaning as an engineer, you probably implement it differently than, say, at the governance level or at, say, at the material level, if you're, say, the manager of an IT. And each one of them approach it from a different perspective, but they all need to work together. And I think Dom was earlier alluding to the point where even though they are managing more the governance and that bigger side, that more strategical side, they are working constantly with all the other departments to figure out what actually is going to be reasonable. Because the trouble with people is if you try to stop them from something that they really want and they really need, they will figure out a way around it. So how to actually build it in a way that helps people and doesn't impair them, but rather enables them. That is also one of the fundamentals. And that's why designing with that from the beginning usually tends to get a lot better results in terms of people actually sticking to it. At that point, they also understand better what's going on. They are more mindful of it, as opposed to, oh, I have this data available. I just go grab it and I'll use it. Well, yeah, it's somebody's social security number, but I really need to work about this offline. Like I have crunch time. I'm just going to grab it to my local laptop. And boom, you now have a whole different exposure vector that you need to guard.
I like to think of through control design based off of data criticality and classifications. So there's public data that's available that we want to be able to surface and expose. There are different control sets that we need to implement there versus processes and security that we need to implement on more restricted data classes. And you know, to Andres's point, I think thinking through security design as a way to enable people to protect information of their constituency to better serve them and their rights as a data subject is a big part of where I think you want to try and take program design as it's being woven into your product design.
I gotta say, I love the ability of having three different departments participating here because you can hear all different sides and perspectives of it. Hopefully that helps see how it all ties better together.
I absolutely agree with you there. And I'd like to take that cohesion, the ability to see things from multiple angles, and ask a slightly different question here. So we've spent a fair amount of time now talking about what data privacy and security are. I'd like to spend a moment and kind of ask about what they aren't. Dave, you brought up the example of redacting information not necessarily being as clear of a solution to privacy as it sounds like. I imagine that similar misconceptions, y'all have probably run into misconceptions about privacy and security during your time working in these areas. What are some of the biggest or most prevalent misconceptions?
I don't think these are like checklists that you can run through and know that your program is secure or is privacy conscious and focused. I think what works for a particular organization, it has to be really unique to the environment and the customers that they serve and the maturity of the team too, right? I don't think it's a state that you can ever really achieve. I think it's something that you're constantly working towards maturing.
Building on top of that, one thing in the research community that we iterate on is coming up with threat models and definitions of security under certain threat models, and then using those definitions as the guidepost for helping us make progress in our research and in developing algorithms, with the understanding that there is no perfect threat model, right? Because technology changes, society changes, and there's always going to be some amount of evolution of those definitions as the applications of those technologies changes. Nevertheless, even though those definitions change, having that definition in mind makes it much easier to understand what the systems that we design are capable of or are not capable of. Whereas I think in the very, very early days, there was no like notion of like threat model or no notion of what does achieving security mean. And that led to attempts to solve the problem that had like fatal weaknesses, kind of like what we discussed earlier with like being able to, even though redacted data looks like it's private, you know, being able to like correlate that with outside information, completely exposed individuals.
Another misconception too is that this has kind of already been alluded to, but these are not programs that are ever going to reach a certain state and be done. There are always going to be a lot of work that needs to be done after the fact, either in the security realm because technology is changing and enhancing, or we're discovering new vulnerabilities every single day. Or if it's because we're in the privacy landscape and your product is changing and you are suddenly collecting new pieces of data that you didn't before, or you're engaging with a new consumer base, or you're expanding internationally, or the regulation that you've been adhering to itself has just recently changed. So there's always going to be a ton of additional work that needs to be done for both of these programs from a security and a privacy perspective. A huge misconception is that thinking that you can ever reach a point where you're just done and you've got the perfect program, it's all set, we're adhering to everything, we've got this framework in place, and that's all we need to do. That's not the case. It should be a growing and maturing program over the course of your lifetime, essentially.
Like lifelong learning. These are the new ways how I need to protect myself. And even then, you still have to continue with the old ways too. So it's like always keeps on increasing. The other misconception that may have sometimes caught some people is having set up a policy or like something at a high level, a governance level, doesn't mean you're actually secure. You have to make sure that it's actually implemented throughout the entire stack, for lack of a better word. There are plenty of cases out there where either say company says they have specific data policy or security policy, but then when you start digging into what do people actually do with all that stuff, you find it that not everybody is actually adhering to it. And sometimes it's even not because people intended to break it, it's just they happen to do it by accident. And that's where, at least for me, security comes a lot in mind, and like the technical controls is how do you ensure that people stays within their limits, and also in case something does happen, how you can detect it. Because say you by accident end up reading or writing data that you're not supposed to, that's not the end of the world. Like that's also, I think, a certain misconception that people have is like, oh, I'm going to get in trouble with security. That's not the case. I would like to invite everybody to look at your CISO or your security officer as like their partner to help you figure out how to do it better. That was one of the big shifts I could see in my previous experiences working in other companies, is essentially a big chunk of work was changing that perception for people like, oh, security, they're not going to let me do that, or they're not going to let me do this. They're going to restrict my access. And I think that's a big misconception for people who haven't had a direct interaction with it, because usually security people would be like, okay, yeah, you can do it, but let's figure out what do you need to do for your function and how can we actually get that achieved? And that's most of my experience has been with anybody who's tried to audit or like control for all of these things.
We're not all sane individuals, but I think taking an approach to security design as a hammer approach is not the right way to kind of build a security program too. I link in the type of security control work and privacy program work more around like trying to hammer in screws. You can't hammer in a screw without really messing up the material that you're hammering that screw into. When you think about control design and program design, if it's not designed for your organization and to the culture and values of how your organization functions, you end up having no poor adoption of things. You end up not being able to really serve your customers. You end up introducing a lot of friction and poor processes into how people try to go about their day. You don't want to design programs that people are looking for ways around. So that's where, you know, that strong partnership really comes into play.
So one misconception that came up a few times was this idea of kind of you don't reach a done state. And that actually links to the last idea I wanted to bring up here, which is security and privacy are both topics where large industry-wide changes can impact you in large ways. And just a few examples, it could be critical bugs get discovered in packages that are very widely used for web development, or potentially misuse of sensitive data, sour public opinion on privacy, even if your company wasn't the one who did that, or advances in data science make it easier for bad actors to infer sensitive data. Things like that can happen as well. So obviously the nature of external factors like this mean it's impossible for you to completely insulate yourself, but do you have any tips for people? If I'm a person listening to this episode thinking I would like to make sure that I take data privacy and security seriously, what are some ways that you can try to limit how bad things can get when large changes like that happen?
I think I'm going to jump in and I'm going to say that I think having a strong governance around it, like some perimeter defenses, can help you guard a lot around a lot of that. You won't be ever able to basically dig into all the pieces of code or anything like that, or even what people do. In fact, you don't want to. You want to have people to be able to be free to do what experiment around, do whatever they want, wherever their creativity takes them. And then having some sort of a, again, I'm going to use the word perimeter around it, that ensures that, okay, you can play with it, but it stays within the company or it stays within the boundaries. I think that is essentially one of the stopgap things every company or anybody should have. From my previous experience, there was one client that I worked with where, for example, this is a little bit extreme case, but they did not have powerful company laptops. They had like these slim like Chromebooks and whatnot. And essentially everybody had a virtual machine in the cloud in their server room that they used as their main workspace. And that way they, for example, ensured that all the data and everything stays within that controlled area. And then everybody just had a terminal to be able to like stream their work. But of course, it comes with the trade-offs. If you're not online, you can't really do the work. And I think that's also a big part of the discussion. A little bit off topic, but that's always a big part of the discussion where the balance lies. And that's, to Dom's point, if it's not designed for your organization, there's going to be more gaps in it.
Looking at different threat sources and thinking about how they are applicable to your environment, if you look at different data sources around the types of incidents and breaches that occur in your space, looking at, like, say, the information sector, over 73% of data breaches and incidents were a result of misconfigurations. So I think, Andres, to your point around like providing guardrails to prevent people from making mistakes are really important ways to sort of start to account for that human element of people operating in your environment, to try and put safeguards around them to make sure that they are, again, enabled to be secure without it being, you know, extra steps that they need to take.
I'm going to use that as a shameless promotion of, say, having like an SRE team in your company, which can build like those base services so that you as a developer, you don't need to actually worry, how do I need to set up security and whatnot? You just consume a module built by somebody who is actually focused and understands security, helps a lot as well, where you can just reuse patterns.
That was a good plug. I'll approach this from the perspective of something bad has already happened, because I think both have made really great points already. And I don't want to belabor those, but if something bad has happened and is happening, taking the approach of transparency with the impacted parties and the affected people, potentially, if it is people. When we see companies get in trouble, it's usually because they've tried to hide something and they've tried to hide when things go wrong. It is our obligation as people who are stewards of this data, who are protecting this data and who are trying to instill trust, is to be transparent when bad things have happened, be it compromised credentials or anything like that, a full-blown data breach, let's hope not. Just making sure that you're communicating and making those aware who are affected so that they're able to make their own decisions after the fact, if maybe they do want to stay with their company or they don't.
And with that, we have reached the end of the episode here. I want to say thank you again to the panel for that incredible discussion. I learned so much during this. I hope everyone listening did as well. And this is a large enough topic. I'm sure we will have another conversation on it at some point in the future. So thank you to Lauren, Andres, Dave, and Dom for being on today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having us.
This is fun.
This episode was sponsored by Klaviyo, as all episodes of the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast are. Here at Klaviyo, we empower creators to own their own destiny. Obviously, data privacy and security, a big part of that puzzle. If you are interested in learning more about Klaviyo and how we fulfill that mission, then the best place to go is klaviyo.com. That's K-L-A-V-I-Y-O.com. If you liked what you heard during this episode, I would ask a few things. First of all, if you're not currently subscribed to the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast, please consider subscribing. You can subscribe to us in just about every major podcast distribution network. In addition, consider leaving us a rating or a review. Those help us in the algorithm so that more people can hear the Klaviyo Data Science Podcast if they are looking for something about data science. In addition, if you have a friend or a coworker or really anyone that you think would be interested in the topics we talked about today and would get something out of this episode, consider sharing this with them. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about what you heard during this episode, the best person to contact is me. The best place to reach me is my Twitter account. That Twitter account is Lawson_M_T. That's LAWSON_M_T. That's it for this episode. Have a great month.